Thank you. Thanks. Nice to be here. Congratulations to those of you who are making it to the final day and also able to be here at 8:30 in the morning. Good job. So my colleagues, Barbara Tajima and Emma Paslakwa, really did some of the heavy lifting on this project, and the funding is provided by National Institute on Drug Abuse and our California Tobacco-Related Disease Program, and I have no commercial interest or financial relationships to disclose. In order to talk about this story a little bit internationally, I have to explain about this story in the U.S. because that's where it started for me. Personally, I work in drug abuse treatment and addictions, and a few years ago, we started, as many before me have, started noticing the exceptional prevalence of smoking in persons in addiction treatment programs. And realizing, I think, that if we, at least in the U.S., if we want to drive down smoking prevalence further in this country, we have to go to where the smokers are. Smokers are in behavioral health in the U.S. They're in substance abuse. They're in mental health. You know, if you've been attending any of these tobacco control conferences here at APHA, you probably know that. I hope you're getting that message. That's the case in the U.S. It may not be the case everywhere. But in the U.S., for example, 4 million people receive some sort of addiction treatment each year, and about 70% of those are smokers. That number will be a little different if you go to a place like Kaiser, you know, a privately funded HMO where everybody's employed. You'll get a smoking rate of about 50%. But if you go to anywhere in our public system, and 3/4 of our addiction treatment is paid for in the public system, that's where you're going to get the 70% rate. So the burden of illness and the cost in the U.S. are concentrated in behavioral health, and this prevalence is compounded by stigma, poverty, social inequality, differential access to health care. So when I was started out studying this in the U.S., everybody would say, okay, it's higher in the addiction treatment population. And one paper would say it's 50 to 70% smoking in the addiction treatment population. Another paper would say it's 60 to 80%. Another paper would say it's 70 to 90%. Another paper would say it's 90 to 100%. So there was a wide, wide range of what is the prevalence in the smoking prevalence in addiction treatment. So we set out to try to see if we could come up with a little bit better estimate, starting with, and to compare to the general population. This line is just the general population in the U.S. That's just CDC data, smoking prevalence over a period of 20 years. If you look at epidemiologic data, this happens to be NESARC data, there was an earlier study, but if you look at epidemiologic data and you find all the people who meet criteria for alcohol use, for example, and find out how many of those are smokers, it's that yellow square, so it's about 35%. If you find all the people who meet criteria for a drug abuse disorder and you ask how many of those are smokers, it's about 50%. But the people who meet criteria for a disorder are very different than the people who actually enter treatment for a disorder or a problem. So we were interested in the people who are entering treatment. And we did a literature review. We found 42 studies. These are U.S. studies now over a period of time where people were reporting on an addiction treatment population. So there are people who came into alcohol treatment, drug treatment for cocaine, methamphetamine, whatever it was. And the paper also happened to report the smoking prevalence. So then you can just graph. That orange line is just taking all these papers and graphing them over time, and you get to see that there's quite a range. First of all, it's much higher than the general population on the bottom. Second, it's quite a bit higher than the epidemiologic data. So the people who are entering treatment have the highest smoking prevalence in these groups that we're comparing. But it also bounces around a lot, from about 65 up to, you know, 90 or some 95%. It really depends on the study, because you're just looking at 200 people in this study, 300 people in this study, and you're just getting an estimate. Well, we just about had finished this work, and we found out that in our own U.S. NISDA, NSDUH data, which is epidemiologic surveillance data, they have two questions. One question is, have you received any drug or alcohol treatment in the last year, and have you smoked in the last 30 days? And if you put those two together, you can get a nice U.S. sort of prevalence estimate of smoking for people who have received drug treatment. And because it's national epidemiologic data, that purple line right there, it doesn't bounce around as much. It's a nice, tight estimate. So that is, I think, now the standard way. I think it's a very good way of estimating what is smoking prevalence in the drug abuse treatment population in the U.S. Now, you have heard about the GATS, about global tobacco use, so I'm not going to talk a lot about that right now, but I'll just say that we were writing about this issue You know, I write about it all the time. Smoking in the addiction treatment population, policy, intervention, blah, blah, blah. And one time an editor said, he said, yeah, you know, this is, or she, I don't know, but they said, yeah, this is really nice, but, you know, we're kind of an international journal, and so we'd like to have a little, you know, reflection of this internationally. So we had a couple of papers. We said, oh, yeah, well, here's three papers, you know, Germany, Austria, here's what it is, and that was fine. But I realized, just as we didn't really know much about it in the U.S. population, we didn't know much about it internationally. So then we just kind of repeated the process, this literature review process, which I'll mention briefly. But we undertook a systematic literature review. We looked for papers that reported on smoking rates in addiction treatment samples. We used PubMed PsycINFO in this ETOH, which is still exists but is not an updated data set, but it was helpful to us. We looked for papers published in English 1987 to 2012. So we did an electronic search first. We identified about 4,000 potential papers. Then we looked at the abstract for all. We looked at all those abstracts, and we had these criteria to include the paper in our study. If the patients were in addiction treatment, if they reported patient-level data, meaning we wanted to know that they had asked the patients themselves. They didn't ask the director, you know, what do you think is the smoking prevalence in your program or your population? And tobacco use had to be mentioned in the abstract. And, of course, in this case, we wanted to look at the non-U.S. studies to see what we could learn. So then if those abstracts, you know, passed our screening, we looked at the papers. And when we looked at the papers, we had to throw a lot of papers out. So we had these exclusion criteria. If it was a review paper, it wasn't reporting primary data from a sample that we were interested in, we threw it out. A lot of times people would mention smoking in the abstract or tobacco, but then they wouldn't report an actual prevalence estimate in the paper, so we had to throw that out. Sometimes, you know, we came across a lot of papers that were smoking cessation papers. Well, they only included smokers, so you can't get a prevalence if it only includes smokers, so we had to throw those out. We wanted papers that had a prevalence based on everybody, and we had to take out the papers that reported on adolescents, or at least I felt that we did, because the issues are so different in adolescent smoking and adult smoking. So we just stuck with adults to keep it simple. So here's what we did. Our initial review came up with these 4,500 abstracts. We, the team that I mentioned earlier, not I did some of this, but I didn't do all of this. But we reviewed these abstracts according to our criteria. After we reviewed, there were 219 papers that still met our criteria. So then we reviewed those papers specifically, those 219 papers. We had to throw them out for this reason, that reason, that reason. There were 43 papers left. And as a last step, we looked at the reference section in those 43 papers, which actually generated a number of additional papers for us, 17 more papers that met our criteria. So overall, we found 60 papers that helped us to look at this problem and to illuminate a little bit better. So the kind of coming to sort of the end of the story, we found papers from 24 countries, and they're just listed here in the left-hand column. There's actually two columns. And, you know, 8 papers in Germany, 7 in Australia. But in about half the countries, we found a single paper that reported on this issue. Now, you can then just make a table, 60 papers long, but I'm not going to show you the whole table because it would be ridiculous. I just looked at I took some of the recent studies to put into this table. And we just list the source, the author, the year. So these are some of the most recent ones, the country where they came from, the sample size, so you can tell if it was a big sample or a small sample, and the modality or type of treatment. We know from our work in the U.S. that even though smoking is 70% in drug abuse treatment, sort of in general, it's actually closer to 80 or 84% if you go into methadone maintenance treatment programs. So there's really something different about opiate use, methadone use, that generates an even higher prevalence of smoking than in the drug abuse population overall. And then you can, in the last two columns, the smoking prevalence that was found in each particular study, and you can compare it using some of the resources that have just been mentioned. You can compare it to smoking prevalence in that country for that year, or whatever the closest year is that we could find. That's what we did. That's it. You can look at it in a different way, visually, graphically. It makes it a little bit more clear. So the little square, blue square at the bottom, is the national smoking prevalence in each of these countries: Austria, Brazil, China, Croatia, and so on. And the black diamond at the top is the smoking prevalence in the addiction treatment paper or papers that we found for that country. And again, I've just narrowed this to 2009 to 2013. And you can see, same as I can, that in every country, the prevalence of smoking and addiction treatment, just as we found in the U.S., but now we're saying, okay, this is globally. Every place we could find data, it's 2 to 3 times higher in the addiction treatment population than in the general population. That's the story. I'm not getting any warnings yet at all, so I must be doing okay. Well, so I'm at the end of my presentation because we don't, apart from pointing out, you know, that internationally this relationship exists, this kind of, to me, it's an extreme high prevalence. This is where the smokers are, as I said, in the U.S. And to some degree, now I know a lot less, I know a lot about the U.S. addiction treatment system. I know a lot less about the addiction treatment system in 24 countries. So there's going to be a lot of, you know, there's a lot of differences in regulation. There's a lot of differences in treatment method, treatment approaches, the size of the treatment system. So there's a lot of things that I don't know. But what I do know is that any country you look at, you're going to see this this discrepancy, this differential prevalence, where smoking prevalence can be much higher in people who are seeking addiction treatment in that country. And so I think what to make of it is I'm not exactly sure. This started out as an exercise. We had found something. We wanted to know if it translated globally. It does. But I think the point I would make about it is the same as I would make in the U.S., that if we want to do effective tobacco control and drive down prevalence, we need to be looking at these populations. And that's in other countries as well as here in the U.S. And I don't know how much it's a part of the FCTC, but probably it should be. Anyway, and that's it. I'm going to stop there. Thank you.